Hi, Bill McKeever here from Mormonism Research Ministry. If you are in the Salt Lake City area, you might be interested in an in-depth class I've been asked to teach for the Lifeline Institute called Mormonism, Its History and Doctrine. This is a 20-hour course that is sponsored by Lifeline Community in West Jordan, Utah. Mormonism, Its History and Doctrine begins on January 29th, and because it consists of 10 two-hour classes, I will be covering the unique history and teachings of the LDS faith much more thoroughly than is possible in a regular church setting. Again, Mormonism, Its History and Doctrine, starts on January 29th at the West Campus of Lifeline Community, located at 4431 West, 8200 South in West Jordan, Utah. For more information about tuition and time, visit our homepage at mrm.org. I think you'll enjoy this in-depth format, and I hope you can attend.
Viewpoint on Mormonism, the program that examines the teachings of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints from a biblical perspective. Viewpoint on Mormonism is sponsored by Mormonism Research Ministry. Since 1979, Mormonism Research Ministry has been dedicated to equipping the body of Christ with answers regarding the Christian faith in a manner that expresses gentleness and respect. And now, your host for today's Viewpoint on Mormonism.
Welcome to this edition of Viewpoint on Mormonism. I'm your host, Bill McKeever, founder and director of Mormonism Research Ministry. With me today is Eric Johnson, my colleague at MRM. We have been going through an article in the Fair Mormon Journal, November-December 2014, an article put together by the president of Fair. Fair is an apologetics group of lay members in the Mormon Church, stands for Foundation for Apologetics Information and Research. Scott Gordon, as the president, put together what he calls his top 10 list of unimpressive Mormon arguments made by what he calls anti-Mormons. Now, we've already talked about that phrase, anti-Mormon. If you want to check out our past broadcasts on this, by all means, please go to our website, mrm.org, and just click on air, and you can see all those. Today, we are looking at point number 5.
It says, Joseph Smith can't be a prophet because he put a rock and a magic hat to translate the Book of Mormon. The church has lied about this. Just look at their paintings. And so he goes on and says, Joseph Smith taught that he translated the Book of Mormon through the gift and power of God. He didn't go into the mechanics of it. That is what the church has taught. Some of his scribes describe different processes that were used. Those descriptions have long been available in history books. The hat has no part in the translation process except to block out the light, so to claim magic for the hat is just plain silly.
How many people do you know have actually argued that the hat was magic?
It sounds like something from the Frosty the Snowman cartoon.
Well, the point is I don't really know of anybody that focuses on the hat. We certainly focus on the rock because we have said many times that the rock had magical or mystical powers of some sort. I mean, after all, Joseph Smith claimed that he could read characters off of this seer stone that he claimed to have found. But let's look at some of the things he says. First of all, he says, the argument is that the church has lied about how the Book of Mormon came about. Just look at their paintings. Now, he may be referring to an article that we have on our website because we do talk about this. But why do we talk about it? This was an issue that the members in Sweden brought up during the Q&A period when the two Mormon historians flew to Stockholm to respond to questions that Swedish members had. They were troubled by the fact that nowhere that they could find in the church artwork does it show Joseph Smith with his face in a hat. So when it talks about just look at their paintings, I think that's a fair question. When it seems like all of your paintings that most people can get a hold of nowadays shows Joseph Smith looking with his eyes upon literal gold plates, that's the image that they want to portray. They don't show pictures of him with his face in a hat.
I mean, even just a decade ago in the Ensign magazine, the front cover was that very image that you're depicting there, where he's reading the plates very carefully and the scribe is writing those down.
One of the statements that Mr. Gordon makes that it really bugs me is he didn't go into the mechanics of it, meaning the translation. Okay, you're right. Joseph Smith didn't spell out how he translated the gold plates, but contemporaries of Joseph Smith did. Mr. Gordon, are you really going to try to tell us that you don't know that? Even though you say that some of his scribes describe different processes that were used, you have to know that at least four people mention that Joseph Smith used a rock and a hat in order to translate the Book of Mormon. You have David Whitmer's account. You have Martin Harris's account. You have Emma Smith's account, his own wife. And you have William Smith, his brother. They all tend to point to this idea that Smith didn't even need the gold plates to translate them into the Book of Mormon. In fact, his brother said that they were lying nearby covered up. We know that the gift and power of God was related in the rock that Joseph Smith had. And yes, he put it into a hat. Now, whoever's calling it a magic hat, I'm sure whoever's saying that is few and far between. Because most of us would say, no, it wasn't the hat. You're right. It was the rock.
The weak point of using a straw man argument. And a straw man argument is merely taking what somebody else is saying it and putting it into your words, but not accurately depicting it. And what he's done here is he's made a case that's not a real case. And instead of coming up with the strength of the position that when we're talking about this interpretation that we see from the paintings versus what really did happen, he doesn't have a good point to make here. No wonder it's not a strong argument for him, because he's not depicting our position accurately.
Well, when he says the hat had no part in the translation process except to block out the light, so to claim magic for the hat is just silly. We would agree. But for you to ignore the mystical powers of the rock, we find not just silly, we find it misleading, because you know very well that that's exactly how this process took place. So when you say he didn't go into the mechanics of it, let's tell the whole story. When he talks about just look at the paintings, I think that's a fair question when you have members themselves wondering why is it that the church does not depict the translation process the way the contemporaries of Joseph Smith described it. They could easily do it. If they can commission an artist to paint Joseph Smith looking with his bare eyes upon actual literal gold plates, they can certainly also commission an artist to show his face in a hat.
Everything that we're talking about here is found on our website. You just need to type in the word First Vision, and the first four or five entries that will come up will show what we're talking about and goes into a lot more detail, which we're not trying to get into here. But as far as this first vision, how it really happened historically versus the way that Scott Gordon is trying to make it.
Point number six is multiple versions of the first vision prove Joseph Smith lied. The various versions of the first vision have been circulating for many years. The versions are almost identical. Key word, folks, almost. And even that's questionable, emphasizing different points. Now, I don't want to spend too much time with this because we do know that there are about nine different versions of the first vision circulating. Some of them made by Joseph Smith, some of them made by Joseph Smith's contemporaries many years after the fact. However, if you look carefully at the details, the word almost, like I said, becomes questionable because in some of these accounts, they're very different. For instance, in Joseph Smith's 1832 account, he claims that only the Lord showed up. And it's made very clear from the context that the Lord is Jesus, not God the Father. He goes to him for a completely different reason. It's not because he goes wanting to know which church is true. He wants to know if his sins are forgiven. Now, this is in his 1832 diary. The account most people are familiar with is known as the 1838 account, which was not even made public till the 1840s. And even after that, we find that various contemporaries of Joseph Smith are not telling the story the same way. Some say angels showed up. Some say an angel showed up. Some say that it wasn't God the Father that showed up. I believe it was Brigham Young that alluded to that God himself did not show up. So there's some significant differences between the stories, but you want to know, in my opinion, the strongest evidence against the first vision? It didn't happen in 1820 like the Mormon Church keeps telling its people.
You're exactly right. If the date lines are wrong and that the first vision did not take place until 1824, you got major problems. But what he says at the end of his argument on this multiple versions, he says, in describing a significant experience, each retelling might highlight different aspects. If the story stayed word for word the same, it would be thought to be a fabrication. Now, Mr. Gordon might be referring to the resurrection, and there were accounts that seem to be different, but they're all reconcilable. But what you're saying, Bill, and what you're pointing out is very accurate to say that how can there be an angel and then multiple angels, or the Lord and then God the Father and Jesus? These are major issues that anybody with any kind of insight is going to be able to say, there's an issue that I have with the depiction that he's giving.
Well, it does look like Joseph Smith is embellishing the story. But I think a strong piece of evidence is, even though this is one of the foundations of the whole Mormon narrative, nobody knew about the first vision until 20 years after it supposedly took place.
And that's a major problem.
And when you have Joseph Smith putting this religious excitement in 1820, which, as we've said, did not happen in 1820, and the church has to know that, there's no evidence to show that it happened in 1820. And when organizations like FAIR and other Mormon apologists try to give the impression that there were other revivals going on in 1820, well, of course there may have been other revivals in 1820, but it's not the revival that Joseph Smith describes. So please, don't insult a person's intelligence by bringing up these camp meetings that the Methodists may have had in 1820. It's not the same.
Now, remember, he said that these are 10 arguments he finds unpersuasive. And yet, when we go back to the one we just did with the rock and a magic hat, as he put it, a lot of people have been super bothered by that and have actually left the church. And when it comes to the first vision accounts, this is a major issue that, again, many ex-Mormons have left the church because of this. And we've talked about the Swedish saints. Many of them had problems with this Mormon story because they weren't told these things. These are things that have been put to the back, and Mormonism has not wanted you to find out. But with the advent of the internet, these past 20 years are a bonanza. It's a Garden of Eden out there. We have so much to pick from and to be able to see what the real history is. That's why they have to come out with the Gospel Topics essays, to basically say, well, that information is getting disseminated wrongly, so we're going to have to correct it. No, they're coming out with those Gospel Topic essays because people are finding out the truth and they're trying to do damage control.
When it comes to the translating of the Book of Mormon, I can only even recall one picture put out by the church where it shows Joseph Smith looking through the Urim and Thummim, which we know is necessary for Joseph Smith to use in order to translate the Reformed Egyptian. Here's the point, going back to his use of the word unpersuasive. Again, we have to emphasize that's a subjective term. Mm-hmm. What may be persuasive to one person may not be persuasive to another. Everybody has their different interests, and some things mean more to individuals than other things. It makes me wonder again, what would be persuasive to a person like Scott Gordon? He doesn't say what it would take for him to leave the Mormon Church. It's just that we know for a fact that a lot of people have been bothered by some of these arguments. Some of them probably more so than others, because we would even agree that some of the things in his list are certainly not all that strong.
But an honest person is going to have to say that of these 10 things that he's talking about, there has to be some bothersome parts to that. I mean, he makes it sound like, oh, there's no problem whatsoever.
We're going to be continuing our look at Scott Gordon's 10 points in our next broadcast.
Thank you for listening. If you would like more information regarding Mormonism Research Ministry, we encourage you to visit our website at www.mrm.org, where you can request our free newsletter, Mormonism Researched. We hope you will join us again as we look at another viewpoint on Mormonism.